Mr. Flynn.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. This matter is here on our appeal of a sentence imposed by Judge Randa in a tax fraud case in the Eastern District of Wisconsin. The primary issue, there are two I raise. One, at the outset, I'll frankly note that the prior decisions of this court are clearly opposed to our position, and we raise it in an adversarial matter to preserve it because the Supreme Court has shown a great deal of interest in Apprendi issues and, in fact, has taken a few cases. We'll be deciding them this October that I think may have some impact, but I recognize at the outset that this panel can't overturn the decision of a previous panel, and I'll dedicate the bulk of my argument to the relevant conduct issue, which I think is also a strong argument in favor of Ms. Leonard. At the outset, the court should understand that initially the government recognized that these were discrete criminal acts and charged her in an 11-count indictment. In an attempt to resolve the case, we had indicated to them her willingness to plead guilty to her own tax offense, fraud which she committed when she filled out an altered form and sent it in a fraudulent form, but she was not willing to concede that she was legally guilty for the others. The position the government took was that they were going to dismiss them if we pled to the one count anyway, which they did when we pled without a plea agreement. We did not, as the Brierton case, there was a plea agreement acknowledging at least that there might be some relevant conduct out there. It was a strict acknowledgement and acceptance of responsibility on her part for the tax fraud she committed. The judge conducted a sentencing hearing over a course of 3 days, one which unfortunately was September 11th, was significantly cut short. But there were 2 days of full testimony, and during the course of that testimony, the facts that were established were that there were a group of people, all related by either kinship ties, two of them were sisters of a man named Roosevelt Carson, who was the live-in boyfriend of my client, Lisa Leonard. Another two were neighbors, and if you believe Patricia Carson, the drug suppliers of both Mr. Roosevelt Carson, my client, and a man named Lee Smith, who was, I guess, the common law husband, or certainly the father of the children of Patricia Carson.
Was at least an unorthodox arrangement of family living, huh?
It was. Well, perhaps not so unorthodox anymore, Your Honor, but the government alludes to him as the husband. I don't believe that was ever established. I think he was perhaps a common law type relationship. He was also, in his own words, a dope fiend. He smoked crack, and the transcript goes on for pages. In fact, it was almost painful getting him to get off the subject of how cocaine had affected his life, specifically crack and alcohol. And significantly, I think, to the understanding of this case is that none of these people were ever charged, despite they're the ones that received the money. They filled out the forms, most of them through H&R Block, and got an electronic return where they would have to actually go.
That's one that baffles me. You mean somebody can fill out a form and then you take the form to H.R. Block and they send it in for you?
Well, according to the testimony of Lee Smith, they actually filled out the form at H&R Block. And that's one of the points of my cross-examination. It doesn't make sense. Why would someone, and none of these people ever claimed to see my client fill out their form. They do claim that at times they provided her with information, but that was what was ridiculous. And in the transcript, it goes on for pages about how improbable this was and how specifically, where did she fill out this form? Well, she went to a library. And, well, what library? Well, I don't recall, and on and on and on. But if you believe him, she filled out a form, which he never saw her fill out. Subsequently, gave it to her, then he takes this information down to H&R Block, and they fill out the form. It doesn't make sense, and that was the factual basis. That's why we wanted a jury trial. We think a jury of 12 peers might have been a little less charitable in their belief that all these people just didn't know they were doing anything wrong. The government never charged them.
Even if they did know they were doing something wrong, or she filled out the form for them and they knew they were doing wrong, wouldn't help her, would it?
Well, in terms of a beyond a reasonable doubt standard, they might just simply choose to believe that this is
not. Yeah, but I say, assuming the correctness of what you said, that they were guilty of sin of cheating the government on their own hook, wouldn't help your client if she prepared the thing and she knew the same things they did.
If in fact, as to
counsel them to do it.
As to the Apprendi issue, but as to the relevant conduct issue.
No, I'm not talking relevant. We're talking about the
okay.
Total thing.
You're right.
If it's relevant conduct.
If she knowingly and intelligently advised them from, yeah. Absolutely. You're absolutely correct. Right? But let me get back to the relevant conduct because I am limited in time here. Even if you accept the government's proposition that she had some either an aid and abettor status or just simply counsel them to do this. They're discrete acts. They are not courts and conduct part of a common scheme. Her single tax fraud count took place in one day. She filed it. How long does it take to fill out an income tax? These are very, very simple forms. We're not talking about a complicated tax scheme here where perhaps there's depletion of oil reserves and things like that. This is basically putting down a false amount of money you earned and claiming earned income credit. In some cases, claiming false dependents that didn't exist. So we're not talking about something that required a great deal of sophistication. These forms are available in every library, in every bank throughout the United States, and there's nothing about this that kind of links them all together as some sort of ongoing scheme, as there was in Brierton, the case the government principally relies upon, because I think they sort of tacitly agree that the first application note really isn't all that applicable. There isn't the commonality here. The victim is the Internal Revenue Service, or I suppose ultimately the U.S. Treasury, but that isn't the sort of particularized victim that there was in Brierton when the woman was the president of the local credit union and had access to a great deal of control and discretion and the ability to falsify the origination dates of the loans so they would escape audit. This is a very, very simple, generic thing. There's nothing common. These kinds of frauds, they happen when I worked here in Chicago. They happen when I worked in Fresno. They're all over the United States. People defraud the United States government. And the fact that they happen to use an altered W-2 form or claim a dependent doesn't exist doesn't tie these together in any way. The government could get a vast scope. And what ties them together is the kinship ties to Roosevelt Carson. They're also remote in time, and in this circuit, the law has clearly been, when there's a remoteness in time, there's a much heightened scrutiny that should be given to other commonality factors. And in this particular case, some of these were 2 years before. They weren't done in preparation for her own fraudulent filing of a tax return. They weren't done to cover up her fraudulent tax activity. They simply are similar in some ways because they involve an altered W-2 form and or dependents that didn't exist. So there isn't this commonality. There isn't this common thread that the government urged. And I know, does that mean I'm going into rebuttal
time? It means you're in your rebuttal time.
Okay, I'm going to cut short at this note then because I think I would like to come back and rebut briefly what the government's going to. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Flynn. Ms. Warwick.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Lisa Warwick, an assistant United States attorney from the Eastern District of Wisconsin. I represent the United States in this case. I'm not going to reach the Apprendi issue. I think it's succinctly briefed in our filing, and that is it just simply doesn't apply to this case. The defendant was sentenced to 30 months, well within the statutory maximum of 5 years, and Apprendi doesn't apply to an enhancement under the sentencing guidelines, which is what occurred in this case when the judge took into account the relevant conduct. I will only briefly address the relevant conduct issue. The judge, her testimony, as Mr. Flynn mentioned, over the course of a few days due to the intervening events, he found on the record, first, that there was a common scheme or plan. And as the application note to the sentencing guidelines defines a common scheme or plan, items or offenses substantially connected one to the other on various levels, that is, common victim, common accomplices, common purpose, or similar modus operandi. And the United States submits that those factors were found by the judge based on the testimony and the documents submitted in evidence in this case. Mr. Flynn has mentioned that all of these individuals were either family members or somehow affiliated with a Roosevelt Carson. Well, that's true, but also they were all affiliated with Lisa Leonard. And in fact, Lisa Leonard's signature shows up on one of their, or at least a signature purporting to be hers, shows up on the tax return as the preparer for Jawanda Evans. Each of the individuals that testified, the tax filers, all named Lisa Leonard as the preparer of their tax return. The IRS, the common victim, yes, granted, is a large victim, but is the victim nonetheless. The plan here was we're gonna submit the tax returns. Lisa Leonard approaches each of these people, gives them a line or some sort of tagline of why they're entitled to a refund. You put money into your house, Lily Evans, so you're entitled to some money back for the money you put in your house. Jawanda Evans, you're taking care of your nephew, So because you're working and doing that at the same time, you're entitled to a refund. For other individuals, it was just the tag phrase of earned income credit, and that supposedly meant they were entitled to some sort of refund from the government.
Were all of these somehow related to this earned income credit?
She used that phrase, we submit at least Leonard used that phrase consistently with each of the individuals.
Would they have otherwise filed tax returns?
I don't know whether they otherwise would have filed. They were not entitled to a refund.
They didn't know any taxes, right?
Right.
So the only reason they would be filing this is because, although they call it earned income credit, there wasn't any earned income, and this was this, however much money you supposedly get when you filed it. I guess it was supposed to offset Social Security tax or something. Or but whatever it is, was that a common thread with all of them?
Yes, and in each of the cases, that is each of the individual filers, either they started out with a legitimate W-2 showing pretty meager wages, usually nothing over maybe around $1,000, $45, $700, in that range. So where there was a legitimate form W-2, if there were a series of them for 1 year, one of them may be altered and two remain legitimate. If there was just one W-2 for a particular year that was legitimate, that one would be altered. Eventually, as the years go on, we submit that the plan or the scheme got even more bolder and that a completely fictitious W-2 was fabricated and attached to the tax return. That was also, as the years went on, in 97, the same year that Lisa Leonard, on her own filing of her own tax return, attaches a completely fraudulent and fictitious W-2. So I think that common theme shows that the scheme is evolving as the years go on, a little bit more bold tactic, a little bit more stepping beyond just altering W-2s, and quite frankly, if there's not a W-2 available, you don't have an option other than that. So that falls into common modus operandi. Secondly, a common purpose for the defendant was to obtain false refunds that these people were not entitled to. Obviously, then it benefited them, but part of this scheme was that Lisa Leonard would ask for either money up front, kind of a down payment, or at times ask for a cut on the refund. When the refund came in, you give me this amount of money, and that ranged from $50, I believe at the end, to around $1,000 for some of the individuals that she worked with. So the judge found, based on all that under the sentencing guidelines, a common theme or plan was established. He also went farther than that and found the same course of conduct. Now, he didn't have to reach it because he'd already found the first, and under the sentencing guidelines, it's quite clear that when you find the first, you don't have to reach the second, but he did. And the same course of conduct fell into the realm of, even though there is a gap in time, the reason that there's a gap in time is that tax returns, of course, are only filed once a year. So you couldn't perpetuate the stream, but for when tax filing season arose each and every year that she had contact with these individuals.
Now, the government dropped all but her specific ones. So there were 10 charges dropped in exchange for the plea, I presume.
Well, there really wasn't. I mean, it wasn't an exchange for the plea because she just pled without a plea agreement. The government made the tactical decision that the government felt that in the issue of judicial economy and justice, it would be, I don't want to use the word silly, but it would be inefficient to proceed to trial on the 10 counts because even if those counts were acquitted, the government would still be presenting the same witnesses, the same evidence at the hearing at sentencing for relevant conduct purposes. It's akin, at least I think, to the bank teller who does an embezzlement in the bank. You charge 5 counts of each of the discrete embezzlements, each different account, maybe different holders of the accounts, the bank's the victim. The teller says, I did 1 and 2, but I'm contesting 3, 4, and 5. The government, in all likelihood, isn't going to proceed to trial on 3, 4, and 5 counts. They're going to dismiss them, leave it up to the fact finder, the judge at that point, to decide are those relevant conduct and present as evidence. And that's what the government chose to do in this case. I would rest the remaining on my brief unless the court has any further, the panel has any further questions.
Thank you, Ms. Moore.
Thank you.
You have 2 minutes, sir.
Thank you. I just want to clarify a part that I think is very important, and I think it goes to the crux of this case and distinguishes it from some of the cases that the government has cited, is that there was no plea agreement in this case. There was nothing given to Ms. In fact, she got an additional 2 points. She was given an acceptance of responsibility on her own fraud, to which she admitted, but was assessed or taken away the
2 points for acceptance of responsibility on the counts that she wouldn't plead to. So this is not the case where there's a bargain and an exchange. We were very adamant. We were prepared to go to trial on the 11th. The Department of Justice continually has said they did this in the interest of justice, but frankly, it's in the interest of the Department of Justice. The benefit they get by doing this is you don't have the unanimity of a jury verdict, and you don't have the standard of beyond a reasonable doubt, and the judge did not find beyond a reasonable doubt. A jury of 12 taxpayers who themselves have to file every year and know what the penalty there might not have been as generous in their assessment of the various flaws of these witnesses. I mean, the judge made its finding, but there was alcohol problems in many of these, severe and long-term drug problems in many of these, and people had filed income tax before. Certainly, as the commonality, as to, I believe it was Jawanda Evans, she claimed dependents she didn't have. Now, that's not common to what these other things were, where there's an altered W-2 form, in some cases a fictitious one. You know who your children are. When you sign it, you're affirming. It's actually under an oath. That you know, and you've reviewed this. So
she must have made some significant money to have. She would have paid taxes otherwise.
She had a job. I don't recall the exact dollar figure, but it's in the record. But she had some job while she was, I believe, a senior in high school or something at that time.
Well, at least she'd have to, if she's claiming dependent, it's got to offset.
Right.
Otherwise, yes. Unless they're going for the earned income.
Some of these people had legitimate income, and whether or not they were going to get a tax back. What they got back was not just the earned income credit, my recollection.
They paid, something had been withheld somewhere.
They did withhold some taxes, and again, I agree with the government, it was fairly minor. But, I know that's my time is up. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Flynn. My thanks to both Mr.